I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Laura Valentini, professor of philosophy and political theory at the Ludwig Maximilians Universität in Munich. We're discussing her recent book, Morality and Socially Constructed Norms, from Oxford University Press. Valentini's research is on contemporary political philosophy, particularly liberalism and cosmopolitanism, the method of political philosophy, and morality in politics. She is the author of several books and many articles on these topics. Well, first of all, Laura Valentini, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for inviting me to do this. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great that you wrote this book, Laura. It's a wonderful book. I loved the deep and rigorous analysis of socially constructed norms and their moral character and grounding. And so I'm looking forward to this conversation. Let me ask you, first of all, what the motivation for writing the book in the first place? Why did you take up this topic at this particular time?
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the question. I think the motivation is, in some sense, twofold. There is an autobiographical side to it, and there is a more scholarly side to it. And I think they kind of came together and gave rise to this book in the end. So in truth, the autobiographical side of the motivation has to do with the fact that because of my life history, I've ended up living in different places, different times and different phases of my life. And these various different places were characterized by rather different socially constructed norms. And so the places in question include Italy, which is where I'm from. And then I was in the United Kingdom for a long time. Now I'm in Germany. And as you can imagine, the norms that govern the communities in these various places can be quite different. You know, think about norms about what the appropriate distance to keep between people might be, sort of not getting too close in some places, and being very close, completely fine other places, or queuing up, or stopping at red lights, and all the rest of it. And, you know, interestingly, while moving from one place to the other, I kind of felt that it would be appropriate, to some extent, to adapt to the local norms, even if they were not the norms that I had originally grown up with or endorsed. And so I started to wonder, you know, why is that? So this is the autobiographical part. There is also, though, a more scholarly side to it. And this is that I have been interested for a while in the debate on political obligation and authority. And so there's this big question in political philosophy, as I guess everyone who's probably listening to the podcast knows, because otherwise they might not be listening to it, whether, and if so, why, and under what conditions we have an obligation to obey the law because it is the law. The fact that something is required by law places us under a moral obligation to comply. That, you know, that is a fact that is considered, a moral fact that is considered plausible by some people, and which political philosophers have been arguing about for centuries, really. So do we have an obligation to obey the law because it is the law, and if so, why? And I wasn't too satisfied with the literature on political obligations, with the answers that were given there. And then I also realized that the question that interested me autobiographically, that is, you know, why, and if so, under what conditions, does the fact that I am placed under these particular set of informal social norms, but norms that happen to be accepted in a different community, give me an obligation to go along with them, was just, in a way, very close to the question of why does the fact that the legal norms that happen to be accepted in a given community place an obligation on me? So I figured, okay, there seems to be a macro level question that subsumes both of these questions. That is, when and why, if ever, do we have an obligation to do something or to refrain from doing something just because norms that exist as a matter of social fact, be they informal social norms, like the ones that affected me the most autobiographically, so to say, or formal legal norms, say that we should do it or refrain from doing it. And so I think this combination of personal biography and literature on political obligation, authority of law that I wasn't fully satisfied with, ended up triggering my interest in this topic and led to the main research question, which is just about the moral normativity of socially constructed norms, which again subsumes legal norms but is not exhausted by it.
Yeah, that's great. And just to be clear up front, I mean, you're interested in particularly moral reasons for obeying conventions or customs. This is as distinct from, because you might think,
prudential.
Well, what's our reason to obey a socially constructed norm? Well, because it's in your self-interest to do so. If you go to Japan or Italy or something like that, you'll kind of fit in better and have a better time if you abide by the rules there. But that may or may not be true, right? I mean, yeah. So maybe say a little bit about, yeah, the sort of the moral versus the prudential approach.
Prudential. Yeah. So, I mean, again, that there are prudential reasons to conform in various contexts seems to be, I mean, a no-brainer. I don't want to make it sound too trivial. But you know that, as you said, if you go to Japan, you know, if you go to the UK and you skip the queue, people will get upset with you. And we have very good prudential reasons for not upsetting people. But there's a further question as to whether they would have reason to be upset with you, as in whether you've really done something wrong, something that you shouldn't be doing from a kind of more moral point of view. And in addition, and this also matters, the question in the context of political obligations, philosophically speaking, has always been a question about, you know, do we do something morally wrong, not just imprudent, if we disobey the law, if we violate the law? So linking it to the literature on political obligation, of course, also partly explains why the focus on morality. Again, another dimension that I think makes it particularly interesting, I said, you know, prudential reasons are a bit of a perhaps no-brainer, is that asking the moral question really genuinely raises a bit of a puzzle. The reason being the following. I am one of those people, and I know that this is somewhat controversial, but also sufficiently broadly accepted, that thinks you can't really derive an ought from an is, right? And so here are these norms that just happen to be accepted. They're a matter of social fact, right? And yet we often seem to treat them as if they had moral force. Deviations from them are being met with the kinds of reactive attitudes or emotional responses that moral violations are met with. So people feel guilty for violating these norms. People are being shamed or are being criticized or are being blamed for doing so. And then the question is, why? You know, is this practice justified? And how can we make sense of this given that these are just pure social facts? And how can we get moral normativity out of pure social facts? There need to be some principles that explain this, moral principles that explain this. And so here where the quest begins. So it's a combination. You said, why the interest in the moral force of socially constructed norm rather than the prudential ones? I think to sum up, the prudential story seems more intuitive and easily accessible. The moral story is the one that has preoccupied political philosophers for a long time in connection with political obligation. And so this kind of situates the book into a longer history of inquiry. And three, there's a particular puzzle that I think arises in connection with the moral force of socially constructed norms. So, yeah.
Great. I mean, just to start with the basics, your first chapter is about what are socially constructed norms. So I thought I'd ask you that question. What are socially constructed norms? We have, you know, there are a lot of different words I think we might use for this: custom, yeah, convention, yeah, norms. What's the sort of concept that you're working with here?
Okay, good. So one thing I should say is that already finding a label for the phenomenon that I was interested in was a little bit of a challenge, precisely because lots of labels in the neighborhood of what I'm interested in float around. So people talk about social norms, people talk about conventions, people talk about customs. And the thing is that I wanted to include phenomena as similar, as diverse, depends on the perspective, as the law on the one hand, but also what we might call completely informal norms like queuing, taking your hat off when you enter a church, etc. And so I wanted to find a label that was not too misleading. And socially constructed norms seem to be a sufficiently ecumenical label. And what do I mean by this? I mean norms that are, to start off in the kind of most basic way, norms that are accepted as a matter of social fact. And a norm I take to be a proposition with normative content, a proposition which includes normative operators like ought, must, and may. So one ought to queue up at the bus stop or something like that. This is a proposition that states a norm. And then we want to know what kind of norm is this. In order for the norm to be socially constructed, it needs to be the object of widespread public acceptance in a given context. So there need to be a large enough number of people in a given context that happen to accept this proposition that you ought to queue up at the bus stop. So for instance, I believe it is empirically accurate to say that in the United Kingdom, you know, there is a socially constructed norm that you ought to queue up at the bus stop, because in that context, there's a large enough number of people. It's difficult to, you know, it's an issue of vagueness. It's difficult to put an, you know, an exact number or proportion on it, but there's a large enough number of people in that context who accept the proposition that one ought to queue up at the bus stop. And now as, you know, publicly, as a matter of common knowledge. And then there's, of course, further questions that one might ask about what exactly acceptance involves. I think intuitively, you know, we get a sense of what it is to accept something, but obviously the philosophical literature on norms gives a variety of different possible answers. And I do so too in the book. And in particular, I say that acceptance involves two attitudes. On the one hand, a belief in the content of the norm, and on the other hand, a robust intention that the requirement that is stated by the norm functions as a general standard of behavior. So on my story, which I call the agential investment account of socially constructed norms, the idea being that the people who accept the norm in some sense put their agency behind the norms. They make an agential investment in the norms. They have to believe that in the content of the norm, believe that one ought to queue up at the bus stop, and they need to have a robust enough intention that one ought to queue up at the bus stop function as a general standard of behavior in the context, that is, as a standard of behavior for one's own and others' actions. There are other ways of characterizing socially constructed norms of or this kind of phenomenon. So other ways of spelling out the idea of acceptance. But for reasons that I explain in the book, and I don't know whether it's necessary to go into them now, you can tell me, I opt for this particular way. But one, perhaps just one further, again, tell me if I'm too much of a chatterbox, being Italian, that's also one of the norms that might be different in different places. So I think it's important to also bear in mind that, like with really all concepts, I don't think that there's a truth of the matter, an independent truth of the matter about what a socially constructed norm is. Definitionally speaking, I think we can come up with different definitions of a socially constructed norm. And in fact, you know, you yourself started off, oh, there are different labels, you know, there's customs and there's convention and there's social norm, etc. And I think how exactly we characterize the phenomenon partly depends on the purposes of our inquiry. And so I think the characterization that I offer, that I just sketched for you, is one that is hopefully sufficiently in line with what we intuitively think of as broadly socially constructed norms. And it kind of ends up picking out many phenomena that we would recognize, yeah, as socially constructed norms, while excluding others. But for other theoretical purposes, a somewhat different definition of socially constructed norms or social norms may be appropriate. So I don't so much say, oh, look, mine is the correct definition, sort of in an unqualified manner. I say, this strikes me as a plausible, useful definition and an interesting phenomenon in relation to the particular inquiry that the book is engaged in. So other people have thought about similar phenomena are not necessarily wrong because they don't operate with this particular characterization.
That's great. And very helpful. I mean, one of the other, I think, helpful things that helped me get thinking about this topic is to distinguish socially constructed norms from moral norms, as you do. That is that, you know, moral norms are not socially constructed. They're not artificial. They, in some sense, stand outside of socially constructed norms and can have a critical kind of purchase on them. I mean, feel free to say anything you want about that distinction.
Good.
But just one thing. I mean, one thing I wanted to, you know, just complicate there is to think about, you know, there sometimes it's not clear in the case of some norms whether they're socially constructed or moral. You know, sometimes we have norms that might be on one side or the other. Are these things artificial or are these things kind of natural, as it were? So maybe if you could speak to those gray cases.
Good. So it's good that you raised this because so it's true that in the book, in a way, I want to draw a distinction between valid moral norms, and I'm not the only one to have done this. I mean, I think the distinction is implicit or explicit in quite a lot of contemporary moral, political, social philosophy, and you know, made by others who have preceded me. So it's true I want to distinguish between socially constructed norms and valid moral norms. But perhaps it's also important to say that the distinction that I want to offer is not maybe as sharp as it might appear. And this goes a little bit in the direction of what you said when you mentioned gray area cases. So the one fairly minimalistic assumption that I want to make is that there exists such a thing as critical morality, that is a set of norms or principles and also evaluative considerations that provide us with a valid or legitimate standard of evaluation for our conduct and our practices, and relative to which certain type of reactive responses, to the violation of which certain kind of reactive responses are justified. You know, as I said before, blame, guilt, resentment, etc. And the minimal assumption that I make in the book is it is not the case that whatever we happen to accept in a given context at a given time corresponds to valid moral norms. Yeah, it may very well be possible that sometimes what we happen to accept reflects valid moral norms, but it just doesn't follow that because that is what we accept, that is the valid standard. That is a very, very minimal assumption that I make. What I don't do, because I suspect this would be another book, well, actually I don't suspect, I know it would be another book, but more importantly, I don't think it's a book that I would be able to write, is to give a full account of where these valid moral standards come from. So I want to be kind of meta-ethically light. And so I just want to say, look, there are critical standards, but I am not committal about the nature of the critical standards other than making the very minimal assumptions they don't completely collapse in what we happen to accept just because we happen to accept it. But I'm open to the possibility that the critical standards may also be in some sense socially constructed, but socially constructed in a more kind of constructivist hypothetical sense, like, you know, what we might be able to come up with in an ideal speech situation. Yeah. So constructed in a kind of hypothetical moral constructivist sense, that could be a possibility. So I don't want to, you know, constructed under an idealized kind of procedure. If one thinks that even the Rawlsian original position is that kind of procedure, that also counts as in some sense constructed, but obviously under specified conditions that are not just what we happen to accept. So this is just to clarify how, minimalistic the assumption about the distinction between the two is. But then you also mentioned the possibility of gray area cases. And so I was wondering whether you had any concrete example in mind of the gray area cases. So
I'm not totally sure. I mean, I have to think about it a little bit. I mean, one of the cases I was going to put to you in a few minutes the next question was to think about like changing moral norms. I mean, there's this notion, you know, kind of traditional notions of gender roles, especially, I think, come up in these contexts about social construction, you know, like who should pay for dinner when you go out on a date? You know, and there used to be a norm about men men paying for dinner? And, you know, what are these gender roles in general? I mean, so conservatives will say something like there's in some sense, I mean, in some sense, these are social constructed, but, you know, in other senses that they kind of derive from nature. I wouldn't want to endorse that particular view, you know, but like, you know, I'm trying to think of it like a particular, you know, more compelling kind of example. But I mean, even maybe obeying the law is a good one, and we'll get to this. But, you know, obeying the law, the law is a social construction. But in some sense, there's a sort of there's a moral reason to obey it. I mean, again, this is, I think, part of the point of your book. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
But yeah. What do you think?
I maybe say something about the gender norms example. So this goes into a terrain that is not explicitly explored in the book, but it's more about what I happen to think, because I don't address this question specifically in the book, because the idea of the gray area, you know, I hadn't thought of and wasn't entirely clear to me what you had in mind before you actually articulated it. But so here's what I think. So I think that a valid moral principle, and I'm assuming that most of my audience shares this starting assumption, even though it's not a starting assumption that I'm in a position to vindicate. So it's one of those kind of starting points that I'm assuming, again, a shared terrain between myself and my audience, is that human beings are fundamentally morally equal. And I therefore think that in order for a system of socially constructed norms to be morally justified, it should in some sense reflect or instantiate this fact about people's fundamental moral status. And I suspect that there is a variety of possible configurations of socially constructed norms that look different, but each of which equally well instantiates this idea. Yeah. So the thought is something like, just to give you an example now with, for instance, marriage. Suppose if in our society we have the institution of marriage, then you know, preventing same-sex couples from being able to enter into that kind of relationship, I think, denies their fundamental equality, this fundamental equal status. But obviously, if we were in a society without that kind of institution, and I'm not, you know, I don't have strong views about whether marriage is a kind of necessary institutional component of a just or egalitarian society, perhaps not. Perhaps we could have a marriage-free state and everything would work really well. Then, you know, that would not be a problem. And it's not the case that in order for there to be a social setup that reflects our fundamental equality, everyone has to have the opportunity to marry. But if there is an important social institution of marriage, then this should not be exclusionary in a certain way. But there are different social setups that instantiate this. Now, with gender roles, you know, who should pay for dinner? I think a lot of it depends on what the social meaning or significance of paying for dinner is, and what the broader social context is like. I mean, if we are in a situation in which paying for dinner has the significance of suggesting that, you know, only one of the parties is the breadwinner, only one of the parties is the one that takes responsibility, only one of the parties that, and so it underpins a broader narrative of inequality between the sexes, and so with particular gender roles, then I think there is something potentially morally objectionable about it. I mean, I think it'd be really odd that you don't agree with this. I mean, you find it also odd to suggest that, you know, it's like written in the fabric of the universe that men should pay for dinner. That seems a bit silly, right? But whether it's compatible with morality or not, I think really, for me, the question would be, you know, given the values that matter, one of which clearly being the fundamental equality of persons, does this particular norm in this particular context, can we interpret it as being consistent with the fundamental equality of persons or not? And if you're looking at a patriarchal, you know, and if this is in the context of a broader patriarchal society, et cetera, then probably no. But I can also imagine situations in which this is just a convention in an egalitarian society, the point of which is to, I don't know, avoid awkwardness, like who pays first? So maybe the first dinner, the man pays, and then from the third dinner onwards, they start switching. I don't know, I'm just making it up as I'm going along, and that would be possibly fine. So yeah, I think there are these kind of fundamental moral requirements, and I think that certain set of socially constructed norms are clearly incompatible with them, sexist norms, for instance, but that there can, that multiple social setups might be compatible with the satisfaction of those requirements. So there's a kind of set of reasonable ways we can organize our societies that are morally okay. So not everything, morality doesn't legislate everything. It leaves us precisely some room for social construction.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I was going to raise these points because in part I was wanted to circle back around to this public component of these socially constructed mm-hmm. norms that, you know, in some sense, it's a little bit unsettled what the meaning of some of these norms are, like, especially mm-hmm. around gender. Like, you know, sometimes I talk with my students about like opening doors for, you know, you talk to the men, do you open doors for women, and what kind of like message does that communicate? And for some, say, well, like, I wouldn't want to do it because I wouldn't want to show that I'm like superior in strength and so forth, and women can do it themselves. Other people say, well, no, I'm just trying to commute. I would open the door for anyone, et cetera, et cetera. So there's something about, I mean, when thinking about socially constructed norms, like, I like the example of like queuing up, because that seems kind of like universally shared, but a lot of norms strike me as, you know, in their public character, maybe just kind of very unsettled and open to quite a bit of different interpretation, maybe conflict about the norms themselves. I don't think that this like harms your theory, but I didn't know if your theory of it can help give us some guidance when thinking about these conflicts.
Good. So yeah, I think these are tricky cases in a way. I agree that the fact that the world is like this doesn't harm the theory in a way, because the complexity is just, you know, inherited from the world. And as you say, social construction leaves room for interpretation as well. I like the particular example that you gave about opening the door. I mean, I think maybe when I was like a 15-year-old, I was a proto-feminist or something, because I actually didn't know why, but I made it always a point whenever I was walking with a male person and there was a door in front of us, I would always make it a point of running ahead and just opening the door. I didn't know why, but somehow I wanted to do it. And I remember my dad, being very puzzled by this behavior of mine. Anyway, close autobiography again. So, but take this norm in particular. I mean, that I think in what you said, two issues were raised. I mean, one issue has to do with the, let's call it ontological status of the norm, and the other one with the moral status of the norm. Ontological status, I mean, whether the norm really is there or not. So there might be situations in which norms are to some extent in flux. So there are cases that are clear cut. You know, our norm here is we open the door when, a woman is walking with us and I'm a man, and clearly that is the norm. And other cases, like, yeah, a few people do it, but most people don't do it anymore. Is the norm still there? Is the norm not there? And this goes back to the issue of, you said public acceptance. As I say, public and widespread acceptance. And then when I said widespread is Bob or general acceptance, I use different terminology. And then the issue is, how widespread does it have to be for there to be a norm? And I can't give you a percentage. So I think to some extent, you know a norm when you see it, when it's there, and then there are going to be gray area cases. And I think any way that we decide, on the gray area cases is a bit like, how many grains of sand make a heap, or, how many hair does someone have to have on their head in order for them to qualify as bald? And those are going to be cases in which also the verdicts of the theory about what we should do with these norms, whether we should go along with them or not, with these quasi norms, proto norms, norms in flux, are also going to be as uncertain as or underdetermined as the existence of the norms itself is. So this is one set of cases, you know, the ontological grayness, so to say. But then there's also the moral one. And this, I think, is, you know, we might say, look, the norm is there. The whatever the percentage is, enough people, yeah, it's met. But what is the status of the norm? Is this a harmless norm? Or, you know, that is a norm that is perfectly morally permissible? And if, you know, which is one of the conditions that I said we haven't got there yet, but which I set for a socially constructed norm to have moral force, that the content must not be morally abhorrent. Or is this a norm that is morally problematic, right? And the opening of the door, I think that is, again, a case that is open to contestation, right? So, and partly also depends on how thick one's theory of equality is. And it also might depend on context. There might be contexts in which the opening of the door is just a general matter of kindness. There might be contexts in which is, again, a sign of patriarchy. And if it's a sign of patriarchy, for instance, I would be inclined to say there's something fishy about it. And in other contexts in which it's just a sign of kindness and the person doing it would do it for anyone, you know, man, woman, child, etc., then I wouldn't see that as being a particular problem. But there are, I mean, and also some of the norms that I discuss explicitly in the book might be susceptible to these different types of assessment, right? So what counts as morally permissible within the realm of the reasonable relative to some fundamental moral principle might be a matter of debate. And so we may be in a situation in which, you know, it is justified to both, or one has, you know, good reasons to both open the door, but also to resist opening the door, doing the kind of thing that I did when I was a kid or like a teenager, and run ahead and open the door. And I think that, you know, this depends on how we interpret the norm. So I maybe proto-interpreted it as in like, oh, you little girl, you don't, you know, you're not strong enough to open it. No, 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 I can do it, of course. But at the same time, if it's just considered a sign of, you know, if it's a conventional gesture of kindness in the same way in which you say thank you to someone when they do you a favor, or you greet someone, I mean, that's, you know, just kind, and I don't think anyone worries about doing that, then it's okay. So yeah, there is this kind of open to interpretation and contestation, and one needs to do the kind of hard interpretive work in context to come to a conclusion.
That's great. One more question on the sort of what is what are socially constructed norms?
Yeah.
You had mentioned about reactive attitudes as being kind of critical, mm-hmm. critical to this, right? That norms are enforced in a certain kind of way through honor and shame and so forth, and all those sorts of different kind of attitudes. It's a certain greater and lesser extent. I was wondering about this because it got me thinking about whether in some sense sort of modern liberal society might have like sort of loosened our commitment to reactive attitudes in the case of maybe some norms, and whether it is critical to it. So I think of the example of, again, I have young kids and you have young kids, so this might resonate
okay.
with you. But, you know, contemporary pop, so the norm is, you know, used to be about that children shouldn't swear, shouldn't use swear words.
I thought it was for adults too.
Well, yeah, it used to be for adults, really. That's gone out the window. So, my daughter listens to popular music all the time, and like Taylor Swift curses every 5 seconds in her song, and Olivia Rodrigo,
okay. It's
that same thing. In any case, I think, I get the sense that there's less of, you know, when a child engages in this, there's a kind of, you know, a talking to a child, say, don't do this, but the kind of reactive attitudes maybe are not as strong as they used to be. Maybe this is just my observation, and I'm becoming an old person, or this is something. but I mean, maybe norms are changing in that sort of way. But I don't know. So how strongly committed are you to the idea that reactive attitudes are critical to socially constructed norms?
So I think I need to be pretty committed, at least for the purposes of my inquiry. So let me again sort of restate this briefly. So one way of putting the point of the inquiry is to say, look, there are these practices, there are these norms that we accept, and then when the norms are being violated, certain responses are being triggered. And these are the kinds of responses that are justified when moral norms are being violated. So the thought is, the violation means you've done something wrong, and so you should feel guilty. You are the object of blame. You are the object of resentment, might even be shamed, et cetera, et cetera. And so then the question is, are we justified in engaging in these practices around socially constructed norms, which would only be justified if the violation of the socially constructed norms tracks something moral, because these reactive responses are justified, again, in response to moral breaches. So given that this is how the inquiry is framed, the reactive attitudes element of socially constructed norms is central to it. And the reason it's central to the characterization that I offer of socially constructed norms is precisely because that's the nature of my inquiry. Possibly others who are interested in socially constructed norms from a purely coordination-based perspective or something like that might not regard reactive attitude as central, although personally, precisely because there's a strong normative element to them, I probably would still be inclined to argue that reactive attitudes are central, but I don't think I need to pick that fight, precisely because, as I said earlier, I think I'm using a concept that is good for what I want to do, for the question that I want to raise. Now, you mentioned a particular example of the phenomenon of the weakening of the reactive attitudes. So I think that two things that I would say about this. So at least in my view, if a child were to swear and close to nobody would take notice, would think badly of what was happening, would thinking, no, like you're not supposed to do this, would blame the child for doing that. I mean, if the child is sufficiently old, I guess blame for 3-year-old is a bit more difficult to explain. I think in that case, the reactive attitude are mostly sort of not really a response to the quality of will that is displayed by the child, but mostly kind of pedagogical prudential. You know, I'm incentivizing you not to do it, not that I think you're guilty or anything. Again, my children are more that age, so that's the way I think about it when I react to that. But you know, if the reactive attitudes were completely gone, then I would say there isn't a norm anymore, right? Then I would say, and so how would we detect the norm? You know, if, you know, swearing all the time and everyone is okay with it, nobody feels guilty, nobody says, hey, nobody reprimands, nobody resents, then I don't know how we'd even be able to detect the presence of a norm. So I would say the norm is not there. Now we might think that, but another possibility is there are still reactive responses, but are not as strong as they used to be. And I thought that that was maybe more what you had in mind. But that I think can be relatively easily accommodated by the view, because the wrongs that are instantiated by the violation of certain socially constructed norms did not all have the same gravity. And so it may be that, I don't know how many years ago, it was generally considered a lot more serious for a child to, a much more serious breach for a child to swear than it is now. And that is because of presumably the centrality that the commitment to not swearing, to children not swearing, played in the kind of self-understanding of the community that accepted the norm or something like that. I think reactive attitudes are pretty central. I think part of the reason I consider them really central is that is fundamental for my inquiry. But I also think that one can defend the view, even independently of the specific purposes of the inquiry, that reactive attitudes really matter, precisely because if one asks, okay, so suppose that no reactive attitudes are there, then how can I say that there's a norm? Like if everyone... nobody stands in line, there's no queue, and nobody's upset about anything, this is Italy, for example, and then, well, there's no norm that you should queue up in Italy. So, yeah.
That's great. So let's talk about your view then of why socially constructed norms have moral weight. You call it the agency respect view. So maybe you can sort of lay out your view and, you know, if you want to, however much you want to say in terms of the criteria. It's a lengthy section. So I want to give you an opportunity to sort of talk it through.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. So as I said, I'm interested in whether we have moral obligations, and I always mean overridable moral obligations, so pro tanto obligations, to do what socially constructed norms require because they so require. The because is very important. So it mirrors what is typically asked in the context of debates about the authority of law and political obligation. Do we have an obligation to obey the law because it is the law, right? Sometimes people describe this as a content-independent obligation. That is, the reason you should do it is not that, you know, what the law asks you to do is very good, right? That's not what explains why you have the obligation, is that the law told you to do so. Yeah, so, and this is really important because very often socially constructed norms, you know, we have obvious reasons to go along with them. So, for example, why should we follow traffic rules, which are socially constructed norms? Well, because it's a very good idea if we don't want to kind of bump into each other with our cars and kill each other and injure each other. And, you know, clearly there are very good independent reasons. So the content of these norms is good. We should go along with them for this reason. Or, you know, why should we not kill other people? Well, we also happen to have socially constructed norms, accepted laws that say you shouldn't kill other people. But, you know, why shouldn't you kill it? Because it's wrong to kill other people, not primarily because the law said so, right? So it's important to really emphasize that the particular puzzle that I am addressing is this sort of because the norm says that you should do it, you ought to do it. And so I need to find a principle, a moral principle, an independently, plausibly valid moral principle that explains why the fact that something is mandated or forbidden by a socially constructed norm, why that very fact is morally significant, as opposed to why the particular thing that is mandated or forbidden by a socially constructed norm is morally significant. But the fact that something is mandated or forbidden by the norm is morally significant. So the obligation, again, has to be relevantly content independent. And the view that I defend, as you already anticipated, I call the agency respect view. And the thought behind it in a nutshell is the following. So socially constructed norms exist because people make a certain kind of agential investment in them. They put their agency behind the norms. This is actually a turn of phrase that I'm borrowing from Ruth Chang, who uses it in a different context, but I find it very useful here. And the reason is precisely because, as I explained earlier on, at least on my picture, you know, when there are socially constructed norms, there is a public acceptance, a public commitment to the norm functioning as a general standard of behavior. And so this is what the norm is. And I think in general, and I take this to be a principle that is broadly accepted within the liberal tradition, that we have at least pro tanto overridable obligations to respect other people's concrete exercises of agency, respect other people's commitments. Provided, of course, this demand of respect is not unqualified, provided the commitments are morally permissible. So, you know, a mafioso may be committed to killing all sorts of people and doing all sorts of horrible things. The fact that he's committed doesn't give me any pro tanto obligation to respect that commitment because that commitment is morally odious. So they have to be permissible. They have to be authentic, so genuine expressions of the person's agency. So you may have a commitment, meaning a robust intention to do something, but that's just because you've been brainwashed or coerced into doing it. Again, you know, I don't have any obligation to respect that particular commitment of yours because it's not authentic. Respect for commitments is ultimately respect for agency, but that commitment does not really express your agency because it's been manipulated. And the third thing is that respect must not be too costly for me. That is, it must not come at too high a cost for my own agency. So the thought is that, you know, we're all autonomous agents. We all should have a space within which we can pursue our ends and goals. I mean, this is a very familiar principle from the liberal tradition, which has been, you know, articulated in a variety of different ways. And so, you know, how do we achieve this? Well, other people need to respect our exercises of agency, our commitments, but not no matter what, provided that A, our commitments are permissible, B, that they are authentic, and C, that this kind of respect doesn't burden their agency so much that it would sort of amount to not respecting their agency. Yeah. And so if we find this underlying principle plausible, and my hope is that this is a principle that readers will look at and think, oh yeah, you know, yeah, that seems plausible. That it's a kind of principle that is being often invoked, you know, within broadly liberal political theory. It has a bit of a Kantian flavor, but it's somewhat more embodied than respect for agency in the Kantian tradition, in the sense that what matters is not just respect for rational agency as such, but for the particular ways in which we exercise our agency. And there are some sort of Kantians who have made this move to the more kind of particular, concrete, embedded exercises of agency. And then one buys the story that I tell about how the existence of socially constructed norms involves this kind of agential investment. It involves a kind of public belief and commitment to, so this is a link commitment, the content of the norms. Then respect for the agency of norm supporters requires respect for the norms that they have created and they have set up, provided that the content of the norm, you know, that the norms are permissible, the commitments are authentic, and that respecting them is not too costly to us. So this is, in a nutshell, the view. So what injects socially constructed norms with moral normativity is this, which I call the agency respect principle. And maybe the important thing to emphasize is it is because whatever the content of the norm is the object of people's commitments, which are constitutive of something being a socially constructed norms, that we have an obligation to go along with it. It's not because the content is in and of itself good. The content must not be bad, otherwise the kind of moral force of the agency respect principle is going to be truncated. It's the same way in which you say, you know, why do you have, you know, I promised to meet you for lunch. Why do I have an obligation? Because I promised. Not because it's a good idea to meet you for lunch. What gives me the obligation is that I promised. It's not the content. But of course, if I say, you know, I promise you to kill Julie, who is an innocent person, or that I'm not obligated. And the reason I'm not obligated is just the content is so terrible that the kind of moral force of the promise is being killed itself by the horrendous content of the promise. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. It does have a strong Kantian flavor to it. This has a kind of German heritage. I suspect you're Kantian of a sort. So, but it reminds me of, you know, humanity is an end in itself. Kant's view, at least as people like Alan Wood and so forth, interpreted as a kind of, you know, what we should do is set about to sort of support the ends or aims of human beings, so long as they're moral, right? If they're immoral, then we no longer have that obligation to support the ends. And it has a kind of, I think it has a Hegelian turn to it, your view, that is that it's about the embodiment of our freedom within particular norms and institutions of society. So that for Hegel, norms and laws are not restrictions on our freedom. They're ways in which they can enable our freedom and express it. And so, you know, violations to those norms are in effect sort of violations of our freedom. Did you, I mean, just out of curiosity, did you have the sort of Kantian and Hegelian sort of here?
This is, again, from an autobiographical perspective, a really interesting comment that you made. So I think my main inspiration came from the kind of Kantian side of things, so to say. So I was not thinking about the Hegelian side of things, or at least not consciously. But I remember, and this was a long time ago, that my doctoral supervisor always used to tell me, yeah, you're Kantian, but you're also Hegelian. You don't realize it. And so you're telling me as well So it may be that I'm a crypto Hegelian after all. But no, I mean, I do think...
Welcome to the fold, Laura. Yeah.
Although, to be completely honest with you, one thing that one has to say is that, and I'm always very anxious whenever I say that I'm a Kantian, because the real Kantians would never recognize me as a Kantian. So, you know, I get inspired by a lot of, you know, great thinkers from the past who have given me much to think about. Maybe that's what I should just stick with. Otherwise, I'll get into trouble. But I think you're absolutely right that, you know, one of the things that I try to do in the book, and I'm not the only one to have done something like this, but is to try to, well, enrich sounds very hubristic. So that's probably not the word that I should use, but try to give a more concrete flavor to the rather kind of formal Kantian idea of respect for person's agency or respect for person's autonomy, or for the rational agents as such, but sort of really what matters is respect for the embodied agents. And the embodied agent is also an agent who, because, you know, we are inevitably social beings, creates socially constructed norms, and those norms themselves are an expression of the agency. And so I don't want to say that the norms don't have a constraint element to them, because they clearly do. And in fact, I mean, one of the problems is it's not that the norms that we have are universally supported by everyone. You know, even the very characterization of socially constructed norms that I offer involves, you know, a large enough number of people in a context. But what about those who don't? And those who don't support the norms, are not committed to the norms, clearly experience them as a constraint on their freedom rather than as an expression of their freedom. And one question is, when is that constraint a constraint that in a way we have a moral obligation to accept, at least pro tanto, overridable? That's in a way a way of putting the question in the book. And under what condition does that constraint not give us any moral obligation, is not one that we are under a moral obligation to accept? And there the answer is, well, if the content is not permissible, or if the constraint is not supported by authentic commitments, or if accepting it would place too much of a burden on our agency. So the restriction of freedom, just to use this terminology that you brought in, for us is too great. And so it would be too great a sacrifice for our own agency. But some acceptance of the constraints is necessary precisely out of respect for the freedom of those who set up the constraints, that is, who subscribe and support the relevant norms.
And so this is all very helpful and compelling. I go, in my mind, I go to cases that I think are again, I think maybe sort of raise questions about the conflict among agential commitments. So I have in mind things like, you know, my daughter and I went to a Hindu temple recently as part of a school trip. And one of the things that the sort of ceremony that was taking place asked men to sit in the front and women to sit in the back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was kind of an issue, right? I mean, so on the one hand, you have sort of agential commitment on the part of a religious community that you're visiting that's that has that sort of patriarchal element. On the other hand, you have our agential commitments, which cut in a different direction. That's one case. Maybe another case that occurred to me, just to throw a different kind of dimension, maybe a more general case about within the political community, is I think about, you know, sort of the norm of the Pledge of Allegiance for, again, this is the young kids episode. For people who are interested, right? Young kids, they go to school and do this thing where they pledge allegiance under God. And there's, I guess, in some way you can say something about, you know, sort of agential commitment on the part of the community to uphold a sort of view of patriotism, which supports civic virtue in the community or some such thing. But on the other hand, there are lots of people who object to this kind of, you know, approach for a variety of reasons. So, I mean, you can help us, like, I mean, in cases like those, where how does your theory help sort of either the agents themselves navigate, or the authority in charge?
So I mean, these are, of course, the tricky questions for an account like mine. And I hope I'm sort of open enough in the book itself to admit that these are hard questions. I'm going to start off with maybe the Pledge of Allegiance and then work back to the Hindu temple. So with the Pledge of Allegiance, and in general, I mean, there's a little bit of a discussion of conscientious refusal and civil disobedience also in the book, which I think, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance case is, you know, in the ballpark of. And one thing that I think the general message of the book invites us to think about is precisely the following, that there is often a conflict between agential commitments. And so if the regulative ideal is one which could be described as equal respect for everyone's agential commitments, we need to try to organize or set up our societies in such a way as to ideally minimize the agency harms that are imposed on individuals whose commitments deviate from the commitments of the majority, so to say. So, Pledge of Allegiance and the God. Of course, in order to come to a well thought out assessment of the situation, I would need to know more about it just because I'm not in the US. And so here I've not had to do a Pledge of Allegiance and the God. Although interestingly, because I am actually, I have a good analogy, I think. So I'm a professor in Germany, and as such, I am a civil servant. And so instead of just getting a contract, I had to swear allegiance to the Free State of Bavaria. Yeah, precisely because I'm a civil servant. And in the Pledge of Allegiance, I remember there was a little, like a half a sentence that made reference to God. And I was told that it was up to me whether to actually utter that bit of the sentence or not. So that I needed to kind of pledge allegiance to the Bavarian state because, you know, in order to become a civil servant, I basically had to, pledge this kind of allegiance. But whether to do it under God was up to me. And so I would find this a kind of solution that strikes me as being in line with the general thrust of the view that I propose, because it may very well be that for someone who does not believe in God, who is not religious, you know, pledging allegiance under God is a bit of an agency harm because it goes against perhaps deep atheist conviction that they have, right? And so ideally, there should be, and to the extent that we think that freedom of conscience and freedom of religion really matter, and they're forcing someone into an activity that might be described as in some sense religious when they are not, is a rather significant agency harm, then we should have, you know, we should set up our rules in such a way that these people can opt out without great cost. And the thing is that if the rule is not there, I think that you know, the person would not be, at least on my theory, under an obligation to pledge allegiance under God, precisely because it would be too costly to them from an agency point of view. The main problem, though, is that, you know, if the opt-out wasn't built into the rules, then without pledging allegiance under God, they wouldn't be able to get the job. So there would be extremely high costs. And I think that this would be impermissible, precisely on agency harm grounds, that, you know, you basically need to carry a really heavy agency burden in order to be able to get a job, an agency burden that is just not in line with equal respect for agents. So that's what I would say about that case. And in general, the broader thought is precisely because, you know, norms can place very heavy constraints on the agency of those who do not subscribe to them, if possible, opt-out clauses should be built into them. Not all kinds of opt-out clauses, because otherwise we don't have a society anymore, but the particular case of the Pledge of Allegiance seems to me to be sort of a plausible one. The one with the Hindu temple, men at the front, women at the back. So this one is tricky. But I think my intuition in relation to it would be the following. So Intuitively, I would say if you decide to visit the temple, which is not something that you're independently obligated to do, then out of respect for the commitment, and I don't know enough about the Hindu religion in order to be able to understand fully the social meaning of, you know, front versus back. Of course, immediately I think it might be something misogynistic, but again, maybe not. I would need to, you know, I don't want to speak out of total ignorance, but decide to visit the temple. There would be something, I think, agency disrespectful in, you know, violating that norm, if that norm is of sufficient religious significance and so on. At the same time, if the norm were one that was indeed bound up with sexist or misogynistic, broader patriarchal structures, then I think it might also be perfectly okay to then criticize the norm, to challenge it, not necessarily by, possibly even, so sometimes I think we may be, all things considered, justified in doing something pro tanto wrong. So again, I would need to know more about the specific details of the case. So depending on the details, probably my view would suggest one of two things. Either there's actually no problem because there's nothing pernicious about the norm, or there is a problem, but the problem is subtle enough that there would be still something sufficiently disrespectful in violating the norm that you shouldn't violate it, but still it may be permissible or even desirable to challenge it verbally afterwards, you know, to speak, you know, why do you have this norm? What, you know, what's the story? Is this not in a way demeaning towards women, etc.? The third possibility could even be it's okay to challenge the norm by violating it, by sort of refusing. But in that case, you know, you might even find yourself in a situation in which you do it, you explain your reasons for doing it, and you say, look, I'm sorry, I realize that on the one hand, I'm doing something disrespectful, but I'm doing it for the following reasons, because I have very good reason to believe that there is something potentially pernicious about this norm. So to some extent, I want the view to embrace the complexity of these conflicts. And in some cases, depending on sort of the gravity of the wrongness of the norm, the nature of the agency harm, if non-subscribers are required to go along with the norm and so on, the verdicts of the view will change. You know, either obligation, need to go along with the norm, or no obligation, you may violate it and not even have to justify yourself, or you may violate it but need to justify yourself because there's still a little bit of a pro tanto wrong. So it's kind of nuanced and very much case dependent. So the view is a general framework. And then in order to deliver specific verdicts, quite a lot of extra material needs to be added, which is precisely contextual and has a lot to do with, you know, what exactly the meaning, the function of the norm in the context is.
Sorry, that's great. No, this has been really helpful because in part because a lot of what you said helped me think through one of the other questions I had, which was about whether your theory has guidance on thinking about how to reform socially constructed norms. Because one of the things that I've thought about in this conversation and reading your book is that, you know, how mutable socially constructed norms are, and they change, they're constantly in flux, and there's sort of, you know, reforms to norms over time and so forth. And so one question could be sort of like why we are obliged to obey them, but another question might be sort of what's our moral obligation to reform them or transform mm-hmm. them. And so your sort of, again, Kantian inflected view about sort of managing the conflicts among agential forms of freedom within the context of these social norms, I think is a sort of useful one, providing sort of opt-out elements there. I don't know if you have anything.
Maybe only like a footnote on this. I, of course, the book and the view that I offer just looks at obligation to do what the norms require because the norms so require, but there's obviously lots of other moral considerations that bear on socially constructed norms. So, you know, we may have reason to reform the norms because their content is morally impermissible, or because, you know, we may have reasons to reform traffic norms because the way that we have positioned the traffic lights actually foreseeably leads to a bunch of inefficiencies and accidents that we really don't want to have. So what I want to say is that at the end of the day, the book only looks at the moral normativity of socially constructed norms qua norms, but there are a lot of further moral considerations that bear on our general relationships to socially constructed norms that are not covered by what the book says. So I agree. So one of the things that the book says is give up, you know, and I think you're right to have emphasized this, or that we can get from the book, is give opt-out clauses to the extent that this is possible, precisely because often socially constructed norms have this kind of majoritarian flavor to them. There are minorities, and these norms, if there aren't kind of opt-out options and so on, might end up imposing unjustifiable agency burdens on them, and we want to avoid it. But that's not the only reason for reforming the norms. We may have a million reasons for reforming the norms, including that they are terribly unjust, terribly unfair, inefficient, et cetera, et cetera. So it's only one aspect that is being covered. It's not a, yeah.
That's good. And we're almost out of time. And although I said before we started that, you know, it's a political theory podcast, I wanted to get the politics stuff, but I totally failed getting us to the politics stuff. But
no, I talk too much. I violated
absolutely
norms
not.
Of podcasts.
This has been totally fascinating. But let me ask you about the political obligation point. Maybe we can make this just a concluding discussion here. Because it's in part an application of your view. I mean, you've been talking about the sort of moral reasons to obey.
Yeah.
Socially constructed norms. One example of a socially constructed norm is a law, and obeying the authority that rests in the law, the sovereignty of the law. There are other views about why we owe obligation to the law. I mean, maybe you could just say a little bit about how you think this view, the agency respect view, is sort of a, you know, a better view in thinking through political obligation than those.
Okay, great. So, thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this. As is relatively well known, there are these two camps on the question of the obligation to obey the law because it is the law. There are the philosophical anarchists who basically say there is no obligation to obey the law because it is the law. We may have lots of good reasons to go along with the law, but the fact that something is required by law doesn't in and of itself give us any reasons. And then there are the supporters or proponents of political authority who say, under certain conditions, we have an obligation to obey the law because it is the law. And here there's like a whole menu of theories of answers that spell out what the relevant conditions are under which we have these obligations. Which have been analyzed extensively in the literature. I'll just name them, because if I were to go through them, it would take another hour and a half. But, you know, there's consent theory, there's fair play theory, there is instrumentalism, there is natural duty of justice theory, there is democratic theory. And in the book, I don't say they're all wrong, because that would be a little bit, again, I think, too hubristic. But I do think that they often misfire. And the reason is the following. So consent theory, I don't think misfires. I think it gives us obligations to obey the law that are not tracking the content of the law, but the fact that we consented, a little bit like, you know, with a promise, you know, why do you have an obligation to keep the promise? Because you promise, not because the, you know, whatever the content of the promise was particularly good. But I think that there are well-known problems with consent theory, the fact that basically pretty much only a mini subset of the population, if any, has actually given binding consent to the government. And so, yes, you know, if the conditions were met in practice, it would allow us to vindicate political obligations. But as loads of people before me have, I think, already successfully argued, although the structure of the theory, I think, works for its purposes, I think at the end of the day, it doesn't deliver what we ultimately want if we want to defend political obligation and the authority of law. But a worry that I have about some of the other theories, like the fair play theory or the natural duty theory or the instrumentalist theory, which is the theory most associated with Joseph Raz, is that although they purport to offer a content independent, to defend a content obligation, independent obligation to obey the law because it is the law, I think ultimately what they offer is a content dependent obligation. Now, because I guess you want me to get to my own view, I won't be able to go into the details of the argument, but the worry is basically that given the type of principle that they invoke to ground or to explain the authority of law, the principle is such that it allows for the possibility that variation in the content of the law, even if these fall within the realm of moral permissibility, so it's not that the law is becoming horrendous, make a difference as to whether we have an obligation or not to obey the law. And the problem is that this suggests that what the principle is tracking, that sort of infuses the law with moral normativity, is not picking out the fact that something is legally mandated or prohibited as being what is morally relevant, but is picking out some feature of the content of the law as being morally relevant. So whether it distributes the fair play, whether it sort of distributes certain kinds of benefits, fair share of, doing one's fair share in a cooperative practice in a way that is sufficiently just, or the instrumental view, the Razian view, whether, going along with what the law requires of us better enables us to comply with the reasons that independently apply to us. And of course, depending on the content of the law, the answer to this question will be yes or no. It depends on whether the law does better than our own judgment. But that suggests that then the obligation is not really content independent. I mean, if Razians were to hear me now, they would scream because they would think I'm mistaken, but at least that's the argument that I offer in the book. I then go to democratic theory. And so I think democratic theory, and I build on democratic theory with my own view, I think democratic theory gets us closer to content independence because democratic theory basically tells us, the law has authority if it is arrived at in a democratic fashion. And of course, a democratic fashion means via a certain kind of procedure. And the procedure is what matters, not the outcome in and of itself. So provided that the law is arrived at through this procedure, then we have an obligation to obey it. And so this suggests that it's content independent. That provided that the law has these substantive merits, we have an obligation to obey it. But no, provided that it's arrived in a, through a certain procedure. The worry that I have about democratic theory is that its justifications, when they are of a kind of intrinsic kind, of course, there are also instrumental justifications for democracy, but if we were to go down that route, then we would go back to basically content-dependent obligations. Oh, it should be democratic because it tracks good outcomes better, but we would be in the wrong realm there. The worry is this, that The intrinsic defense of democracy has to do with how democracy instantiates, typically, a certain idea of equal status or equal respect for citizens, because everyone is allowed a voice in the decision-making process in circumstances in which there's reasonable disagreement, but we need to find, a common outcome, an agreed solution. And so, substantively, we won't find an agreement, but at least we can have a procedure that takes everyone into account. I mean, I'm being kind of very general and rough here, but that's, I think, often the idea that is more or less invoked in intrinsic justifications of democracy. But here are two things. The first is that, as others have pointed out, it's not clear why only democracy can instantiate this procedural equal respect and not a system like a weighted lottery. So why should we, I understand we need a procedure that instantiates equal respect, but why democracy? And B, there are many different ways of setting up democracy. There are many different aggregation, for instance, voting aggregation rules that can be used in a democracy. I mean, there are, and also there's like first past the post, proportional system and so on. Why is it though, that when in a particular context, the rules are of a particular kind, a deviation from following that particular instantiation of democracy strikes us as morally problematic, even if from a kind of abstract moral point of view, different instantiations are more or less on a par? No, so why why this particular version of democracy and not that, and why democracy rather than a weighted lottery. So the intrinsic equal respect principle, I think, doesn't get us exactly to democracy. And so that doesn't get us to why we should do what the law requires, because it so requires when it is democratic, since what that really means is, why should we follow the particular democratic procedure that we actually happen to find here, and deviations from it in this context would be morally problematic? Why would switching to lotocracy or something be morally problematic? And here is, I think, where the agency respect principle comes in as a sort of a way of bridging this gap. And the thought here is the following, that if in a particular context, we have a particular broadly morally permissible democratic setup, a particular concrete instantiation of democracy, that is presumably by virtue of the fact that within that system, a large enough number of people support, are committed to those kinds of democratic rules. And agency respect for the permissible, hopefully authentic commitments of norm supporters is what explains why in this particular context, the particular democratic procedures that are consistent with independent principles of equal respect and so on are the ones that we need to go along with. So it's agency respect that explains why the decision-making procedures that produce valid law in a given context, provided they're morally permissible, that is consistent with equal respect and so on, and supported by authentic commitments, have moral normativity, and that is out of agency respect for the commitments of those who support the relevant procedures. And that is meant to kind of bridge the gap between, you know, democracy, equal respect as what is necessary, which is then immediately translated into democracy. But one question is, why democracy and not lotocracy? I mean, it's consistent with my view that if we had a lotocratic system consistent with equal respect that was generally accepted, et cetera, in a given context, then we should go along with it, because of agency respect for those who support the system. But given that we broadly don't have that, we don't tend to have that, but what we have is democracy, provided that is morally permissible, consistent with equal respect, and supported by authentic commitments, then that's why the decisions that are spat out by that system are ones that we should go along with, content-independent reasons, namely agency respect for norm supporters.
Would your view be compatible with an authoritarian system, as long as it's... like has commitment to equal respect?
Which
you can imagine
so
authoritarian
system. One of the difficulties
could.
Is that I find it hard to see how an authoritarian system could be consistent with equal respect. So if you tell me, is your view compatible with any system that is compatible with equal respect and supported by authentic commitments? I think probably the answer is yes. The worry is that if the system is, you know, under a plausible understanding of what counts as authoritarian, probably the compatibility with equal respect to the authenticity of the commitments would have to be put into question. But if there was kind of a logically coherent way of designing that system, then probably I would have to say yes. I realize that we're more or less at a time, but maybe one little tiny thing that might be worth saying is this, that although my view offers, in a way, a defense of political obligation or political authority, the defense is extremely qualified. And so I don't know whether I'm more on the side of the anarchists or more on the side of the ones who typically defend political authority. And the reason is that I don't treat the law as fundamentally different from other socially constructed norms. And the obligation that I think we have to go along with the law, because it is the law, I didn't talk much about the rule of law. I mean, what I think it's out of respect for people's commitment to the rule of law. And if the law happens to be democratic in that particular context and permissible and so on, then that's what it is. There was more talk of the rule of law in the book that I didn't get a chance to get into. But in general, the thought is that the obligation is a pro tempore obligation. And, so it's one that can be overridden. The sources of which are no different than the sources of the obligation to obey norms that don't qualify as legal. And so while I think often in the literature on political obligation and authority, the law is really treated as special, to some extent, on my view, it is not. And we have an obligation to go along with it because it is the law, only under very strict conditions. You know, the content needs to be, and the procedure needs to be morally permissible. The commitments need to be authentic. And, you know, there's a big question about whether the authenticity requirement is satisfied. And also going along with it must not be too costly for the individual's own agency. And, you know, we're already seeing cases of conflict where my view would probably say, well, here, no obligation to go along with the law out of agency respect grounds, because the cost that it imposes on people with commitments that clash with what the law requires and which are also permissible commitments would be too high. So it defends it, I mean, political obligation or the authority of law, but in a very heavily qualified way. So I'm not sure who my friends and my enemies are in that debate. I suspect everyone is my enemy. Maybe I just put myself in a really uncomfortable corner.
I see. This is a philosopher's task, I think. Well, Laura, this has been, it was a great book and a great conversation here. So thanks again for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was great fun. Thank you, Jeffrey.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.